friends. You're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, and I'm delighted to welcome from Limerick University in Ireland a friend of mine for, what would we say, two, three, four, at least four, if not heading into five decades. Carl Corcoran, you're very welcome indeed.
So good to be with you, Adrian, after all these years.
After all these years.
And you're right. It's decades and decades.
I have
the fondest memories of being in your studio with Paddy Noonan and Seamus Green, who have left us. Yeah, we did a live session there. This is going back into the 90s.
Yeah, so we're still around anyway.
yeah, both of us.
I want to bring it back to, an earlier time. First of all, where are you? Where were you born, bred and buttered?
Born and raised in Dublin City, in Clontarf on the north side.
My God,
Had a musical background in the sense of a typical Irish family. Everybody had their party piece and music at every social occasion. So it was never considered as a career, and it's a funny thing, to look back on, as you say, 5 decades and to realize that actually I did manage a career in music, and after 5 decades looking back, it's been wonderful.
Yeah, it is. It's great. You know what they say, and I would like to be included in this, is find something you absolutely want to do for the rest of your life, and then after that, you have to figure out how to get paid for it, because, which is so true for so many,
Do something that you have a passion for, and you never consider it work.
That's for sure. I do want to ask you though about the musical family, musical background. Now, you didn't start off your music career as Carl Corcoran, the songwriter. The director of Master Songwriting at the Irish World Academy, University of Limerick, and a board member of Music Network Ireland. Now, can you bring us back pretty much to the time that everybody thought you would be taking up this hobby that you made a career out of for your life?
Well, the choice after school was actually for a legal profession, and I started law at UCD, dabbling in music on a social level, but never thinking that it was going to be a career choice. And some friends of mine, the Crean family, who you may know from Clare.
Oh, yes.
They recorded an album, and one of the family members, Dermot, was a friend of mine, and he, recognizing or knowing that I had a decent singing voice, asked me to sing a song on the album called The Green Hills of Clare. Mm-hmm. And it was as a result of that recording that EMI came across my voice and decided that they wanted to sign a record deal for me. So instead of the typical story of me going around searching for a young musician going around searching for opportunity, it came knocking on my door, and a conversation ensued, decisions were made, and this persona or alter ego came about called Jamie Stone. It was a record company decision that they wanted to manufacture this artist and promote it. And I did 3 albums under the name of Jamie Stone, which were pop albums. Nothing to do with Irish music, aside from the fact that it was by an Irish person. But I recorded 3 albums of original material, and that was the beginning of the whole thing. A couple of hits here in Ireland in the 70s, and then in what is now to be regarded as typical fashion, I was dropped by the record company. And it seems like the end of the road for Jamie Stone. And I decided at that point to head to America in mm-hmm. pursuit of the songwriting career, or at least the songwriting opportunities. And it was while I was doing that that I got involved in the Irish-American community, and that then became a career direction for 20 years, living in New York and working. I was resident in the Minster Boy in Bayside for 15 years, and then I had a couple of years with Paddy Noonan. And it just became, you know, that was what yeah. I was. But always pursuing the songwriting on the side and trying to sell one's wares, making connections with different elements of the music business. And then when I decided that it was time to come home to Ireland, I'd had some radio experience, as you know, yeah. in New York. And then I got into the radio world here, and I worked in RTE for 20 years.
Yeah, you know, I just want to stop you there, only because, you know, an immigrant who comes to America and returns after 20 years and is hired as a producer and a presenter and allows you to, you know, basically do all of that and then knock another 20 years out of it. That is no small, you know, you should send a text to your record company and say, okay, how are you fellas doing? I'm doing okay.
I've been very lucky. Been very lucky, Adrian, and it's been a wonderful journey in so many different facets of the business, and now to be in that kind of mentoring role where I'm now guiding other and not all younger. There are in my class in my master's program at UL, there are some gentlemen and ladies who are in the 50s, in 60s, who are interested in the whole process of songwriting. So, I mean, it's a huge, huge privilege and honor for me to be in that role and to be able to share my experiences with them.
Well, if your reviews and references are anything to go by, I'd say myself, you're way up there. And congratulations on that. I just want to ask you, you know, many of us, including myself, when we came here, you know, from Ireland, and you didn't have to be that terrific or brilliant, there was an Irish-American band and music scene here that again started in the home. And, you know, there were so many accordion players, violin players, fiddle players, and it was the guitar became a relatively new a choice of instrument. Many would say, you know, God, you must be going back to the year of Adam and Eve, but actually, you know, in the 50s and in the 60s and 70s, guitar was relatively new, and due to a lot of people who were delighted, particularly young kids who were delighted to get away from the piano lessons and the violin lessons. Can you just zero in on that period?
Well, I suppose, I mean, I came to New York in 1978, and I was amazed at the vibrant Irish community and the Irish-American community. And you're right, guitar was probably a fairly new addition to the arsenal of the musicians. Charlie McGee, I think, was probably one of the...
That's right.
Charlie, a resident in the Barleycorn.
Yes, he surely was.
And
Yeah. And oh, rock-a-bye, baby, so warm in your nest. Remember that one? He was an amazing artist, too, and there were so many of them. Not in any way distracting from, the solid, the extraordinarily solid Irish-American music scene here, that at a time we were leaving Ireland, we thought maybe, we had moved on. I think it would be fair to say that Irish America had played a tremendous role in keeping traditional Irish music, for that matter, keeping all kinds of music alive.
I would agree with you. Yeah, absolutely. And the reemergence here in Ireland of the focus on Irish music is partly because of this transatlantic seed. It's a synergy that exists, one feeding the other. And when you have people like Joni Madden, who, was the stalwart of Irish music in New York for so long, and she's equally lauded and regarded over here in Ireland. So, there's that transatlantic link. And one is feeding off the other. It's reciprocal in that sense that there's a wonderful connection.
Yeah.
But yes, you're right. It's Irish America that kept that tradition alive.
Yes.
At a time,
and still does.
Even here in Ireland, and still does. Absolutely, yeah. That my example of Joni Madden is one. But at a time when Irish music wasn't cool in Ireland.
Yeah.
It was thriving. It was thriving in America.
Yeah.
It has come the full circle.
Let me ask you, you're doing absolutely fine. You have a tremendous following. You have a career at RTE, and that's Radio Television Éireann, which is the national broadcast company of both radio and television. But you got this call and an invitation from one of Ireland's amazing musicians, Micheál O'Sullivan. And tell us how that came about.
First of all, through the radio persona that I developed with working in RTE, I did have some connections with Micheál, the artist, because he was a recording artist. He was a personality larger than life, so you couldn't help but be persuaded by his dynamic personality. Mm-hmm. And I would have him, as you're having me right now, as a guest on the program. So we'd established this relationship, and in the middle of the 2000s, 2005, I decided that I wanted to advance my academic credentials, and I went to the University of Limerick because the station that I was working was RTE, but it was Lyric, which was based in Limerick. So I went to Micheál in Limerick University, and we had a chat, and I went into the room looking for some thoughts on what I could do, and I came out of the room signed up to do a master's in community music, and I didn't even know what community music was, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I spent that year in his company, or at least under his shadow, and his tutelage and mentoring. So we became good friends, and in the following 10 years, I maintained a connection with the Irish World Academy. I was director of their summer school for 3 years. So we established this relationship. And Micheál knew that I had a songwriting background. He had just started the songwriting master's program. It was the only one in Ireland.
Yeah.
And he wanted someone that had experience, that had knowledge of the academy and the philosophy and the ethos and all of that. So he came to me, at a time when my radio career was coming to an end because RTE have a policy of not employing anybody over 65. Shame, shame. And
double shame.
Indeed. And coinciding with that departure, this opportunity came my way. So the timing was perfect, the opportunity was perfect, and I grabbed it with both hands, and I just launched myself into it with great delight and with great success, not only in terms of the product that we're producing, but also in terms of my own personal journey, because I then started to go back into songwriting, which I had more or less stepped back from for all those years on radio, because, as you know, radio and a position like that can take all your energy and take a lot of your creative concentration. So I had dropped the songwriting to a degree, but then being immersed in the songwriting program in the university, I just found myself inspired. I found myself surrounded by creative people. Every conversation is a creative conversation. And it personally, it's been a great advancement.
My guest friends is Carl Corcoran, songwriter, broadcaster, industry consultant, and director of Masters Songwriting and Irish World Academy, University of Limerick. Now, I want to just ask you, though, about... well, first of all, the perception. It's one thing, and I would know to take off in a direction, whether that's broadcasting or acting or as an author, whatever. Are the odds much less in your favor when you pick, say, songwriting in terms of paying for the bacon and eggs? Do you have to do when you're songwriting, must you come up with a song that's going to be very popular? How
the hit that we all
wait for a lifetime?
Yeah. Well, in terms of what the course offers, it really isn't a question of how to write songs. It's more a question of why we write songs. And I think that the master's program is designed in such a way that it's more forensic of the individual, and it's introspection in the sense of finding out what is this creative voice that we seem to be responding to. The byproduct of something like that could be writing a hit, but it's not the main purpose. It's not the main thrust of the program. The program is more to develop the person on a personal journey and to find the voice. If you write the hit song, well, yes, wonderful. That's the byproduct. As you say, we're all trying to do that. We all like to think that we could, at some point, write the song that is of huge personal value, but is also of an immense appeal to a wider audience. Mm-hmm. But the selling point of the program is not to, we'll teach you how to write that hit song. Those who are accepted on the program are people who have a knowledge of songwriting, have a sense of songwriting already. And the whole idea is in an academic format, and it has to be academic because it's a master's program. There's a lot of inspection of what they call the arts practice. And the arts practice in this case is the craft of songwriting. So, the historical background to songwriting from the 12th century through the 21st century is looked at and inspected. And that in itself is kind of an acceptance of the legacy of songwriting. I feel that as a songwriter, I am in a way continuing the legacy of Hildegard von Bingen, who did music to religious text, or John Dowland, the 15th century English lutenist, who was, again, a songwriter in the sense of creating his own music. And then right through the centuries with Schubert writing his beautiful Lieder compositions, and then into the great American songbooks, Tin Pan Alley,
yes,
up to the Brill Building, and then into modern pop writing. So all of that is looked at. But that's a very long answer to your question.
No,
Adrian.
It's very interesting because I could only imagine, you know, as a youngster out of school pursuing a career, and you know, your favorite uncle sitting you down saying, "Well, what do you think you're going to do with the rest of your life?" "Well, I'm going to be a songwriter." "Oh my
yeah.
God!" You know.
Yeah.
"Well, what about the day job?" Which yeah. of course we've all had experience with that. "Well, this is great, you know. Yeah, working 6 nights a week, yeah, and a couple on that, yeah, fine. And now what's your day job?" It does have that, and I don't know how much of that has gone away, which is what makes, in addition to our friendship, is why I would really, why we wanted to get you on the program, because to go from, again, Jamie Stone, and yes, we're going to play some of that a little bit later in the program, but to go from there to not just a career, but a stellar career in the University of Limerick as a mentor, as a tutor, as a professor, that's one hell of a jump, and something that didn't come overnight. As we know, that some singers sing forever, and all of a sudden, tongue in cheek, it said, "Well, I was discovered overnight."
Yes. Well, Val Dunican had a famous comment that he was a 17-year overnight success, and it's true. It's very rare for the overnight success to be just that.
Yeah.
People spend a lifetime, and I've spent a lifetime. I don't consider myself to be an overnight success by any means. I am an individual who's been fortunate enough to have had a wide, vast experience of different elements of the music business, and I'm now fortunate enough to be in a position that I'm being paid to share that experience.
Right.
And to mentor others, because it's life experience as well as music and talent.
Yeah, absolutely. My guest, Carl Corcoran. Carl, I want to ask you about a group called Ardu. Who are they? And because we don't know that much about them here, but they sure as hell have made a name for themselves at international festivals all over Europe. Who are they?
They're a group of six singers, a cappella singers, so they're performing without accompaniment. And this is a particular genre and style of music that is very popular at the moment. I mean, there's a huge industry built around a cappella choral singing.
Mm-hmm.
And Ardu are the leading vocal ensemble, a cappella vocal ensemble here in Ireland. And they're all highly educated and skilled singers who have been in various choral combinations through their short careers, because they're all young kids. They're, young kids. To us, Adrian, anybody under 40 is a young kid. So I consider the young kids.
In my case, anybody under 70 is, Anyway, no, tell us.
So I came to be aware of them again through the radio, because they had recorded material, and I was aware also through my involvement with Music Network, which is a music development organization that develops artists and audiences in different genres. And this was one of the musical ensembles that came to my attention. And I've always loved choral music, and particularly a cappella choral music. So the opportunity to collaborate with them came my way last year, courtesy of a song that I had written or co-written, and I felt that it had potential to be dressed in a choral fashion. And I basically cold called the individuals concerned. We had a discussion about the possibilities of working together, and the ensuing result from all of that was this beautiful recording that they have now made of two of my songs, actually, but one in particular is probably our focus of attention today, in the sense that this song, written in the aftermath of 9/11, became this beautiful product because of the choral arrangement. And they are including it on an album that they're releasing later in the autumn. But it is of direct reference to 9/11, and, of course, with the 20th anniversary coming up, it was all very well timed and intentionally timed. You know, and perhaps this is another facet of my experience, is that being somewhat astute in the business sense, that one looks for opportunities. Right. You know, if you're a songwriter or a musician, you're responding to what's current, you're responding to what's around you. And 9/11 was, aside from being such a personal, having a personal impact on me because of my New York connection, it was just one of those events that I felt obliged to communicate in some musical fashion, and the song was the result of that. But the association with Ardu has developed and is I'm honored and flattered that they would decide to go ahead and do this recording, which is just glorious. Which brings us up to the present moment.
That's funny you should, well, it's not funny, but you say that about Ardu, and then they say the same about you. It's like a mutual admiration society. Yet you totally have been much more, it sounds like you were just invited at the last minute. You have, not only for Ardu, but with so many choral groups, you know, you're the professor. You're the person that they look to. You're the, you know, next to Mihola Solovoin. I don't know, you know, any others, but it is something very special. And take Ardu, I'm not giving you a chance to respond to that, because I want to ask you, you know, about, you know, the touring. Sometimes we think of choral groups as, those who, sing in choirs, primarily in church, maybe, once a year. But again, singing a cappella is very, well, let's say it's not in vogue a lot of the time, but now Ireland seems to be like taking the lead in that.
Yeah, there is a very healthy choral community and choral network in Ireland, as there is in the States too. I mean, I'm aware of that, because I would keep an eye on developments of various elements of the industry and the music communities. But yes, choral music is very popular, and so too are the professional elements of choral music. And those who get involved in the professional side of this genre are people who are extremely well skilled, very talented, and it's very demanding. It's an art form that requires a form of personal excellence. All of the singers in Ardu are excellent in their own right, and it's the combination of the six voices that just works so well. It's not by accident. They work hard at it.
Now, they also, of course, have earned a great reputation, you know, at international festivals in London and Edinburgh, Finland, Croatia, Austria, Italy. What makes them unique? Because I think the question I'd really like to ask is, are choral societies, are they generally a cappella, no band, no drummer, no anybody showing up at the last minute? How would you describe, and are there in the genre, are there different types of choral groups, those who are part of huge international concerts and whatever?
Yeah, well, most of the choral ensembles are unaccompanied, or if they are accompanied, it's a very light accompaniment. It might be a chamber ensemble, or it could be a piano, or just an organ. It's not often that they're accompanied by a band. And then there are the a cappellas, which are the unaccompanied formats. But all these international festivals that take place around the globe are all featuring highly competitive feature of the genre. That when Ardu go to Finland or they go to Austria or Italy, it's typically in a as a reward for being excellent in their field. And, you know, it is a highly competitive market.
Sure. And generally, Carl Corcoran, I want to ask you, when a choral group, say, goes to an international festival, is that generally a once-off, or would they spend, say, in Finland, would they do several concerts or performances, in different parts, different segments?
It's usually over a couple of days that these festivals run, and when choral groups are invited to participate, they would be involved in maybe four or five different performances throughout the over the period of the or over the duration of the festival, and that would be it. Then they would return home. Mm-hmm. They don't go on tour as such.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's the visiting experience to a festival, and it's highly influential and very good on the CV and the bio and all of that. But most of these ensembles are not strictly relying on that particular element of their career for a living, because most of the people that are involved in that at that level are teaching elsewhere, or they're involved in other choirs, maybe they're doing church choirs, you know. So it's very seldom that ensembles like this are doing it exclusively as a means of earning a living. There are a few, of course. I mean, you know, people like the King Singers, who are well known, they are an entity that are commercially successful, and they're backed by a record company, and they have tours that would take them on the road for 6 weeks at a time. So yes, there are those, but generally the choral community works as kind of just part of their professional experience. I suppose It's a niche market in a way.
It is, they also have been featured not only on TV and radio in Ireland, though. You know, they wind up on the Ray Darcy show, but they also, you know, BBC. There is they've made a lot of progress, and I was going to say in a short time, but I don't know, has this been for a short time?
No, it's a short period of time. I think I could be maybe corrected on this, but I would be thinking 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
in existence in one format or another. And they have achieved all this success because of their excellence and because there are platforms that are available for such performances. And once you get the reputation and you get the support from the community, from the industry and from the academic world too, because that plays a big part in it, that they get the opportunity to make all these performances and appearances.
Yeah,
and you know, the talent in the singing side of things is amazing, but their artistic director Kieran Kelly is an amazing talented arranger and highly skilled. You know, this is a man who has spent a long time in learning his craft and getting qualified in this area, and it was he who put the choral arrangement together that makes them sound so good. So, again, it's individuals just driving the bus, so to speak, moving forward for them to succeed so well.
You wrote the song, which we're about to hear, and this is probably the first time it's being aired on our side of the Atlantic, because...
Indeed.
Launch was only last week. The song is called "The Phoenix."
Well, the song was written in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 in 2001. I was home barely 2 years at the time, so New York was still in my blood and in my mind and my heart too. So when the tragedy hit, it was, as it was for everybody, it's one of those moments that you remember where you were on that day. It's like the Kennedy assassination. And it affected me because I knew many members of the fire department. This is the community that I had worked in New York for 20 years. As you know, Adrian, playing at society events, you meet all these people, you get to know them. Some of my friends were firemen, policemen, and I was deeply affected by it. And that inspired, I think, an emotional musical outpouring. And my lyricist, Art McGann, who we had worked together for years. In the Jamie Stone days, we had written songs together. And we continued our collaboration even while I was in America and he was in Ireland. We wrote a beautiful song for Danny Doyle called "The Rose of Saigon," which paid tribute to the Irish connection to the Vietnam conflict. So we're writers who are inspired by what goes on around us, as many songwriters are. And this was the emotion of the time, November, or in the wake of September 2001. And Art came up with this magnificent lyric, which really encapsulated the images of a tragic day, but at the same time, I think reflects the spirit of strength and defiance of the aftermath rather than the shock of the day, and hence the title, Rising from the Ashes. It was this spirit and this positive coming together, the melting pot of emotion, the strength of friendship, the strength of solidarity and support, which was so evident in the aftermath of the tragedy. And so we wrote this song inspired by some of the lines from that famous saying at the bottom of the Statue of Liberty, the Emma Lazarus poem.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. And the idea was that Lady Liberty, or the Lady of the Harbor, was viewing this tragedy with saddened eyes, but her light, her lantern, or her lamp was going to light the way. And there are elements of those images throughout the song. And we wrote that in 2001. And like many of our songs, I revisit from time to time. And there were a couple of versions that were never really recorded professionally or brought to a level where they were made public. But the recent revisit that I did last year, and the sense of putting it into a choral environment, brought about the collaboration with Ardu. And so I think what they have done musically and the sensibility of their approach to it has captured the essence of the writer's endeavors in a beautiful way. And then the video that has been done to accompany it is equally emotive and inspiring.
And that video is on YouTube. I want to thank you, because we're going to go to the song. Thank you. It's great catching up after all of these decades, and good luck. Good luck to you, Professor.
It's been a pleasure, Adrian. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Thanks to Anya. And I look forward to seeing you face-to-face in person in the very near future on either side of the Atlantic.
Right. Okay. And friends, the song.